Emotional well-being. I don't know if you've noticed, but there doesn't seem to be an awful lot of it around at the moment, does there? In the world generally. Emotional well-being. It seems there is so much anxiety and depression and neurosis of all kinds around. And people seem to take offence so easily these days, don't they? The merest thing. And with that comes a lot of vindictiveness, it seems. The world's quite an unhappy place at the moment. Oh, thanks, Paul. What a cheery intro. Well, I've got to face facts. There's an interesting experiment going on in the US in their universities and colleges. The powers that be are quite anxious or are determined that their young students should avoid that anxiety and that depression and that neurosis. They want them to be emotionally well and happy. So they've created this structure to try and ensure that the students avoid any form of discomfort, experience anything for which they may feel offended through the teaching that they receive. Right? So this means that tutors have to give what are called trigger warnings if they believe that they're going to teach anything that would trigger in the student a memory of a past trauma or something that would offend their view structure or anything like that. So the idea is the student avoids anxiety, avoids unpleasantness because the tutors ensure that they don't hear any of it. There are no ideas, no words, no concepts that would give rise to any unpleasantness on the part of the student. The rationale being, therefore, the student will be emotionally healthy, will be fit, because they will have avoided the triggers that create such problems. This has meant that books like The Great Gatsby by whoever it was, mine's gone blank. Yeah, don't tell me, I don't remember it. Don't whisper it. F. Scott Fitzgerald, thank you. Has been taken off the books that are read on courses because in that book there is reference to misogyny, there's reference to domestic violence, and if a student, either themselves or seeing their parents, and has been traumatized by such an experience, they can't have that trigger because that will cause them to feel anxious. Does this seem sensible to you? Because this is what's going on. I found out. This leads to something else, which in the US, and their lovely terminology, they call microaggression. Have you ever come across this concept of microaggression? Let me give you an example. So, a tutor is reading an essay by one of his students. The student spells the word indigenous with a capital I, but it's not the first word in the sentence. So the tutor corrects that and decapitalizes it. Is that what you said? The student is offended. The student is offended because he or she, let's say she, identifies her ethnicity as indigenous. That's what she calls herself. She says, "I am indigenous." Right? So she deliberately used a capital I because it was, in that sense, referring to her the way that she saw herself. So she experienced an extraordinarily painful feeling. Right? And this is what happens, and this is why it is neurotic. This is why this is a neurotic, what's the word I'm looking for, distortion of reality. So there is an immediate rejection of what she sees. She experiences a painful feeling, but then what happens is, and using the lingo again, this isn't Buddhist lingo, but it is appropriate, there is emotional reasoning takes place, which takes that painful feeling and associates it with the tutor. And it is the tutor that is giving me the painful feeling. Right, so there's that projection. So what happens with emotional reasoning is that in that situation the tutor is seen entirely in terms of that painful feeling that is experienced, and that is how the student then perceives the tutor, just simply on the basis of that painful feeling. So the tutor then becomes the aggressor. The tutor has done this to me. Yeah? So the tutor is responsible for my feeling offended. The tutor is responsible for my anxiety with regard to this. So the student complains to the authorities. And this is a true story. The tutor was blamed by the university and was sanctioned by the university for having done that. What a weird and peculiar world we're living in these days. And what's the outcome of that? Does this resolve the problem of anxiety by trying to avoid these triggers? Because you think about microaggression, okay? Where does it stop? If it's got to the point where the tutor has to second-guess every single word that is written, in terms of whether this is going to create anxiety in the student, what about his facial expressions? What about his mannerisms? What if he's talking to a student and he's just remembered, oh, I've left all the washing on the line. And so this sort of look comes across his face momentarily, a micro-expression, which has absolutely nothing to do whatsoever with the student. The student is in this place of great power. Vindictiveness is built into the system where the student is required to essentially report the teacher. What's stopping them from reporting them? Oh, he glowered at me. A dark shadow came across his face. He's an aggressor. I mean, it's just taking it on a bit, but it's what a problem. So does this resolve the problem of anxiety in the student? Or the tutors are going absolutely mental, with great respect. See, because there I go. See, because that somebody might be offended by it, that I used that kind of expression. I didn't mean anything. There was no intent. Think about it. The tutor was acting out of compassion, teaching a young adult the way in the world, and this is how you use grammar, etc. And is hurled over the coals as a consequence. It doesn't. It merely increases anxiety. The student will also be similarly anxious about going into these situations. It actually increases suffering. And that's the point I want to make, that the attempt to avoid the painfulness of life increases suffering. Easy to say. Difficult to deal with. It is possible to experience complete emotional well-being. You can't stop the body doing what it does. It gets old, you can't help that. Things go wrong in life, of course. There are ups and downs for everyone. This is a human existence, but it is possible, nonetheless, to come to full emotional well-being. And that is what the Buddha's teaching is designed for. That and nothing else. It's designed to show us a way of us discovering for ourselves exactly how life works. Okay? He summed it up in the Four Noble Truths. There is suffering in life. There is anxiety. There is depression. There is the experience of painful feelings and discomfort and unwanted situations. What drives this wheel of suffering is a passionate desire for life to be different than it is. Craving or resistance, but it is possible through developing understanding of how life works, it is possible to free yourself from that this passionate craving for life to be different and come to a full and complete understanding of life as it is. And in the absence of that passionate craving, that neurotic distortion, we might call it, there is just the most wonderful peace and happiness. The first task for anybody who wishes to transform their lives from these distorted perceptions of life and this constant fretting and resisting and wanting life to be different, there has to be a fundamental change of heart. Somebody has to go from somebody who habitually blames, who habitually finds faults in others, or themselves, who habitually puts up blocks to any kind of suggestion of a way forward. They've got to transform themselves from somebody who believes they know what's the trouble is and become somebody who knows that they don't know the answers. They become somebody who opens up to the idea that we are all individually responsible for our own minds, for the actions that we perform in mind, in body, and in speech, and that through taking that responsibility, and it's nothing to do with blame, but taking that responsibility means that new pathways, new possibilities open up. Nobody can inject that into somebody. It has to come from within. It is somebody who has a change of heart. They decide, they have a moment perhaps of humility, or they decide that actually I'm not solving this, am I? It's not being resolved, and there is an opening and new possibilities emerge because they decide to take responsibility. The Buddha said life is the creation of the mind. The kind of experiences that we go through are based primarily on the way that we behave. And the Buddha maintained that mind, as well as being the forerunner of all things, was the most powerful in creating the world as we perceive it and as we experience it. You can change your perception of life. Perception is malleable, it's not fixed. You can go from seeing life as terrible and awful and difficult and painful to seeing it as joyful, happy, meaningful, mysterious. It is up to the individual, it is up to you personally, whether you decide that you want to make that change. And that's important because you cannot reach cessation of suffering, you cannot reach emotional well-being through avoiding suffering. The way to freedom from suffering is to look at the suffering. That's why it can only come from within. Nobody can. I can't sort of like wrestle you into your chair and say, look at your suffering. It's not going to work. You'll probably have me put in prison, I imagine, if I tried to do that. And I would be blamed, and rightly too. It has to come from the individual. But if it does come from the individual, if they are willing to make that fundamental change in outlook, and they're willing to embrace a new way of looking at the world, you really can't do better than the Buddha's teaching. It is such a comprehensive description of the way life works. Of course, perhaps at the beginning, that has to be taken with a certain pinch of salt and a certain amount of faith, but we all know this teaching training is experience-led. It's somebody finding out for themselves whether or not the Buddha's teaching is an accurate reflection of the way life works. And as someone progresses, it becomes ever more evident. You keep ticking the boxes. Yep, 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 yep. And in that way, you gain a tremendous faith and a tremendous confidence, which allows you to rest mindfully observing even the most uncomfortable and difficult experiences. It's incredibly important to remain open-minded in terms of one's view structure with regard to the Buddha's teaching. Because there is such a strong, deeply entrenched view in our culture now that there's only one life. And it does explain a lot of why you get these kind of systems that like have emerged in the US, whereby the emphasis is on avoiding suffering. There's an acknowledgement, tacit acknowledgement that there is suffering there, but if you've only got one life, you're talking about a very short time frame, especially if you take out your very young years and your dotage out of it. You could be talking maximum 50, 60 years of really fulfilling your time on earth, and then there's only oblivion at the end of it, right? The Buddha's teaching, fundamental, the view is that there are innumerable lives that we go through. This is only one. And this one is special because this is the one where we have to go to school, where we have to start to learn, or not start to learn, but continue to learn about the rules of life and how life works. Now, if you embrace the Buddha's teaching and you go from a one life view to just the mere possibility, the openness, the suggestion that actually the lessons that we learn in this lifetime will carry us through into other lifetimes, and that this may very well be the reason that why we're here. It's not so much about becoming famous or having lots of money or all the worldly things. Actually, the deeper reason that we're here is to learn the lessons of how life works. How does that open up life for somebody that has these neurotic dispositions and distortions and is resisting life? How does that help them to have confidence to embrace this idea that you can actually look at your suffering, that it's all right, that's why we're here, and it is an incredibly positive thing to do? Because at the beginning it's very difficult to sort of say, all right, I'll do it. Having that wider, that longer lens look at life and seeing it in that kind of context then creates a different headspace, a headspace where it is possible to spend time being mindful, looking at life as it unfolds in order to learn lessons. And as a consequence of that, our thoughts change. Our thoughts change from the neurotic preoccupation with my own success, my own happiness, my own freedom from distress and anxiety, and it starts to embrace a new way of looking at the world, a world where the aspirations become more spiritual. In the Buddha's teaching, we have three main aspirations: the aspiration towards loving kindness, towards compassion, and friendliness. Loving kindness is the friendliness, which is one I'm missing. Compassion. Oh, renunciation. Oh, yes, because that's my character type. I always forget the renunciation. Renunciation, loving-kindness, and compassion. Your outlook begins to change because your view structure begins to change. And already that neurotic preoccupation is beginning to change, because one recognises, begins to recognise, one accepts that the driving force behind all these rebirths are our actions. And as we become aware that our actions have results, we get to decide the kind of results. We can't decide exactly. But if you act with renunciation, if you act with friendliness and compassion, you know that the results of that are going to be nice. They're going to be pleasant. They're going to be happy. You'll experience perceptions that you enjoy. There will be less neurosis. The very action of helping others, the very action of looking after others, the very action of being careful with your own behaviour, they are rewards in themselves, but also you know that they're going to produce these wonderful results. So already your neurotic preoccupation is changing, it's altering. Your self-obsession is changing to a more realistic view of what life is all about. The Buddha emphasized the keeping of precepts and the development of what we call the parami, generosity, friendliness, being helpful, being truthful. So many good things come out of that. A real confidence, a real self-esteem. You can look at your own behaviour since you started keeping the precepts and started actively becoming more outgoing in terms of the way you help others. You see that there is a definite shift, a move away from the neurotic preoccupations and a genuine enjoyment of being in company, of being around people, of feeling a part of life, of self-esteem, of knowing that your own actions are generally are good. That's certainly the case with me. When I entered in full-time training here, I very quickly felt settled and felt like I belonged for like the first time in my adult life. I actually belonged somewhere, and I was looking at life in completely different ways than I was before. And that leads to a lack of concern. It didn't matter what job I was given to do. Even if initially there was a resistance to doing a certain task, like the one I always found difficult was being asked to go out in the car. I think, oh, I'm a monk. I'm supposed to be living a... Now you're asking me to go out in a car. And there was always like this subtle resistance to it. But actually, when I got out in the car and I was driving down the country lanes all by myself, and I was like, hey, this is great. Why did I even resist? So in the end, I just wasn't resisting the tasks that I was being given to do. There was no neurotic concern about it. There was just letting go and getting all these lovely resultants, like the self-esteem and the sense of belonging. A lack of self-concern, which when I went to meditate, allowed me to look at anything because I wasn't concerned. I was happy. I was peaceful. Relatively. More so than I was. And that's what it does. It allows your mindfulness such space. The mundane teaching gives such space to the practice of mindfulness because you feel all right about yourself. And so then the stuff that comes up, and of course stuff's going to come up. You've got resultants from past actions that you need to experience and learn from. You need to experience, say, the rising of a memory about some past trauma and experience the feelings associated with that and experience the way you respond. Actually observing, say, a neurotic distortion, like the one I was talking about before, the emotional reasoning distortion, where you experience a painful feeling and then immediately associate it with something external, like your mother or your father. They brought me up all wrong, all that sort of stuff. And actually observing that whole process. You can only do that if you've got that cushioning effect of living a good, ethical existence. So that's what gives you the power, that's what gives you the ability to rest with the unwanted and the painful, with also the understanding of what you're doing, and that's obviously critical. And that's why the support of a teacher is so helpful. So yes, mindfulness is about stopping avoiding. It's doing the opposite of what the US colleges are doing. It's allowing whatever triggers want to come up to come up. It's looking at your responses, looking at your resistances. And through, as I was saying earlier, through observing your responses and seeing the false as the false, so truly seeing something for what it really is, you drop it. You drop it. You don't have to think about it. You don't have to reason it through. Say, an example of doubt. Oh yeah, this is what. Okay, so here's a scenario. As an explanation of why you don't have to solve your doubts with regard to this teaching. So, the scenario is there's a teacher he's giving a talk, and there's somebody listening to the talk. So this is a spiritual teacher, perhaps enlightened, perhaps not. The person listening doesn't know. And he thinks, well, can I really believe what this guy's saying? Is he credible? Is he making it up as he goes along? Don't know. So there's doubt in the mind, right? So the man pipes up and asks the teacher, are you enlightened? In his own mind as a way of trying to resolve the doubt. So the teacher responds, I will answer your question, but what lies behind it? And so the guy says, well, I don't know whether I should believe you or not. And so the teacher says, well, if I say I am enlightened, does that resolve the doubt? And he thinks for a moment and thinks, no, that doesn't make a blind bit of difference. Whether you tell me, if you say you are, I still don't know whether to believe you or not. He said, well, if I say I'm not enlightened, does that resolve the doubt? He says, no, that just leaves me even more confused. And that's the point. The doubt can't be resolved. How is the doubt resolved then? Well, the teacher says, well, the only way to resolve the doubt is if somebody accepts instruction, goes and meditates according to the instruction as best they can, and finds out for themselves whether, as a result, they're suffering lessons. Eventually, you'll come to know whether or not that teacher is enlightened or not. But doubt is not resolved through avoiding it or trying to get rid of it. The way you resolve a doubt is by resting with the doubt, not seeking a solution, and observing the doubt's true characteristic, which is you're thinking these doubtful thoughts, and a moment later you're thinking about whether your favourite football team won, or the state of the climate, or the state of the economy, or listening to a bird singing sweetly in the trees, and you're not doing the doubt at all. And with time you recognise that doubt's characteristic is entirely transient. And you never had to resolve the doubt at all. You merely had to understand the true characteristic of the doubt. Doubt is one of the most pernicious, neurotic distortions that any student of meditation experiences. It's the one that destroys somebody's meditation, the journey of meditation, completely. The others can really hold you up, but it's doubt that destroys. It's so corrosive. But it is completely a neurotic preoccupation. And endlessly trying to resolve the doubt doesn't resolve it. Seeing it in its true characteristics, but what do you have to do? You have to sit with it. You have to allow it to be there. With all that painful feelings and the discomfort that come with it. Do you see? I'm trying to sort of encapsulate a really big thing in a way that everyone can understand it. But that is, in its essence, what this teaching is all about. It's about learning about the way actions give rise to results, and we experience those results, and then we respond to them. And it's understanding the way that we respond. Without resolving the doubt, the doubts disappear. With all the hindrances, mindfulness becomes so well established that when a hindrance arises, you see it for what it is, you understand it, you don't seek to get rid of it, because its true nature is to arise and pass away, arise and pass away. And as a meditation practice becomes established, and your mindfulness deepens and grows and becomes really firm, it becomes easier and easier just to acknowledge what's there without having to do anything. So everything is done without you doing anything. Fantastic. So what are we talking about? We're talking about the abandonment of the neurotic preoccupation, not feeling that you have to resist. So with that comes this tremendous sense of emotional well-being, because you're not clinging to those hindrances. You're not trying to change the world. You're not trying to change yourself. You're accepting that level, life as it is. And you experience lovely periods of freedom from hindrances as a consequence. That freedom from hindrances is freedom from neurotic preoccupation. It's emotional well-being. But you can go even further with the Buddha's teaching. As your power over negative thought processes grows, you find that you experience periods in meditation that are peaceful. They might not be terribly deeply concentrated, but they're peaceful. And often people come to me and say, well, what do I do next? There's so much more you can do in not just in controlling your preoccupations, but by getting rid of them completely. And that process is the process of Vipassana meditation. And this is where we begin to go beneath the surface appearance of things and really start to look at the mechanics of how conscious experience actually arises and passes away moment by moment. It's an extraordinary journey, unlike anything else you could possibly do. And you just do it sitting in a chair quietly. Quite amazing. But you can actually observe the way in which conscious experience, that means actual life, coming into being, passing away, moment by moment, and you can comprehend at the most deepest level that there truly is nothing to grasp at. There is nothing that you need to control. That life arises and passes away due to impersonal conditions. And although that might sound cold and a little bit weird and eerie and alien, the actual experience of it is delightful. Because you start to realise that all this time, what purports to be ego, this part of the mind has felt that it's in some way responsible for keeping the whole of existence going. It's like this, you start to realise that there's been this tremendous burden that you've been hanging on to all this time, believing that somehow existence depended on you keeping it going. And so there's this fundamental aberration, this fundamental belief that I have to control life. As more and more you see into how ungraspable reality is, you let go. You cease to cling in the most deepest level, emotionally, not just intellectually, but emotionally. You just let go, let go, let go, until in the end you just let go completely. And the neurotic distortion, the fear is, if I do that, the universe will collapse. But what you discover is that the universe just carries on doing exactly what it's always done. It just never required that belief that you had to control everything, that you had to control outcomes. And you realise in that moment that life truly is perfect as it is. It just happens all by itself. This is just all happening by itself. There's nobody controlling it. And so there's this just most wonderful freedom, sense of space, timelessness, this wonderful sense of understanding. It's such a simple thing, but it is understood through and through that life is just doing itself. And this is just the universe knowing itself. It's just the most glorious, simple knowledge, understanding. Yet what's disappeared? Any remaining distortion, any remaining neurotic preoccupation. You retain, for you, in big inverted commas, retain your charms, your funny little ways. You haven't lost anything. All you've lost is that insistence that you have to control, that you have to resist, that you have to fix outcomes. And so what you're left with is just this wonderful freedom to be and play and do in whatever way that you see fit. No resistance, no suffering. So to sum up, emotional well-being is available for everyone, but it does require somebody to take proper responsibility for their lives. embrace the Buddha's teaching, straighten out one's views, develop aspirations towards harmlessness, live kindly and live ethically, which allows us to develop mindfulness with a sense of spaciousness, see these neurotic distortions for what they are and let them go, and get a far more realistic perception of life. And then as that neurotic preoccupation lessens and you let go, it's possible then to delve deeply into experience and really come to realise that release from all the distortion whatsoever and come to see life as it truly is. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.